Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Sam Langsdale and Elizabeth Cootey talking about Monstrous Women in Comics, their new edited collection. Sam and Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting us. We're really excited to talk about our work.
Good. Yes, indeed.
So I'm hoping we can start by you sharing a little bit about why you put this collection together. What made you want to create a collection on monstrous women in comics?
It started when we met at a very small symposium on sacred texts and comics. Elizabeth and I were both invited to share work there. I brought a paper that specifically was looking at the Marvel comic, the X-Men, and specifically the Dark Phoenix saga within that book. And I was using monster theory to sort of explore that text in particular for a variety of reasons. And I got really great feedback at that symposium, in addition to getting to know Elizabeth quite well. And before we left, we decided we'd really like to do something together in the future. So in the following years, I kind of set my mind to organizing my own conference, specifically around this theme of monstrous women in comics. And the first people that I hit up were the people that I'd met at the symposium. So I reached out to Elizabeth and said, you know, please come play with me. So the conference then that resulted, that shares the name with our book, was held at the University of North Texas. And I have to say, I realize I'm biased, but it's one of the best academic conferences I've ever been to. And I organized it, but it just, the collection of people that came, the range of research that was shared was so interesting and inspiring. It was fun. Everybody got along. I mean, it was, again, one of the few events where people actually elected to spend their spare time together rather than running to their own rooms and, you know, not turning up until the events. And so for me, it was, I think, the success of that conference that really got me excited. And I will just say, from my perspective, it's completely to Elizabeth's credit that the book exists, because at the end of the conference, she brought it up. I mean, I was kind of, you know, on the down by the end of the day. I was really tired. And she said, let's do this. Let's make a book. I'm going to help you. We're going to do this together. And I remember thinking like, oh, okay, you know what, can we talk about it tomorrow? But it was that initiative that I think really, really sedimented that this was a worthwhile project.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the credit really goes to the conferences themselves that we were able to put something like this together, both the first Sacred Text in Comics conference and then the Monstrous Women in Comics conference. The fact that both of those were successful events where we really did get to exchange ideas and, you know, have really see the ideas blossom. Mm-hmm. In other words, both were very nurturing kind of intellectual environments. The kind of conference where everybody's there to really understand the material better and to help each other along. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of that Monstrous Women conference, I thought, well, you know, the other conference had a book come out of it. It seems to me that this one could too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really just the idea that these are ideas that need even further development or deserve further development and to be shared.
So before we get into some of the chapters in the collection, can you, one of you or both of you, kind of talk about the overarching framework and how you sort of thought about this and how you framed it and put it together? There's five different parts. So if you can share a little bit of that, that would be great.
Sure. I will say that the sections in terms of how they formed, I think happened pretty organically. Mm-hmm. That's maybe slightly misleading. So as somebody who obviously had some control over which papers were admitted to the conference in the first place, I have some memory of the kinds of themes that kept occurring in terms of people's mm-hmm. abstract submissions. But that, of course, doesn't really give you the full picture of what's going to materialize. And as Elizabeth said, the kinds of papers that were actually shared were really enriching, but also exploratory and open. And I think through the process of the conference, it was easy for me then to see how we wound up with the sections that we did, the kinds of papers that materialized, the kinds of work that were being done, kind of lent themselves to the divisions that we made based on the kind of work that people were interested in doing. Now, I will also say, when you gain any kind of familiarity with monster theory, I think you see these kinds of categories over and over again as well. Some of this is not unique to our book, but resonates with that sort of wider field of monster studies and within that kind of monster theory in particular. So some of the themes that we chose definitely echo the kind of scholarship that's being done more broadly.
Right. And I mean, the sections that you see in the book do at least somewhat reflect the sections that we had as sort of groups of people presenting papers and working their work together mm-hmm. at the conference. But there is some resorting that we had done as part of the editing process just to give everything a little more sense and a little more flow. But I think the overall, you can really see that these are papers that were worked on alongside one another in each one of the sections.
Right. And so your first part, like part one, is sort of the origins, it's origins, agency, and paradoxes of Monstrous Women. So can you talk a little bit about what is going on in those chapters? Highlight, you can sort of talk about each of them or, you know, sort of highlight some of the major themes if you'd like. But just sort of, it seems to be a bit of setting the stage for some of what you've been talking about.
Sure. So the chapter that starts that section is mine. So it's about rewriting to control how the origins of Harley Quinn, Wonder Woman, and Mary Magdalene matter to women's perceived power. Now, this was an idea that I had as part of the conference, that is to take, two women from comics and try to understand how their differences in their origin stories might help us better understand the origin story of Mary Magdalene, like the character in the New Testament. And the idea that there could be, I mean, my background is in biblical scholarship, and the idea that comics could offer something really tangible to people's understanding of people's lives especially the way they're told in the biblical text, was just really intriguing to me. And the fact that this idea of monstrosity was such a useful kind of theoretical tool to get at what these differences were doing was one of the reasons that I was really attracted to the idea. And when Sam gave her first paper, that it's sort of, that's the kind of theoretical lens that might be helpful to me. So really, this whole paper is all about these origin stories and how the comics can be of real use in looking at the biblical story to try and understand how women's power is perceived in these ways, and sort of the, what is it about women's power in particular that might be of use here, or what might be changing, what might be disruptive in these different cases. So that was my chapter trying to, and honestly, it was not a sense of vanity that made it go first. It really is the origin chapter. So we're trying to figure out how to kind of kick this thing off. And then J. Richard Stevens created a chapter there all about She-Hulk. So again, kind of keeping with these DC characters, kind of breaking us in slowly here. The DC characters in mind, and then he goes to a Marvel character to try and, use these kind of big comic characters to help people start to explore what we mean by monstrous here. And he really gets into the idea of the monstrous feminist frame and try to understand the post-feminist discourse that's possible with She-Hulk, right? How can this character that whose origins literally come from a man, right? Whose comic book birth is about her blood transfusion from her cousin Bruce Banner, right? How can this be part of a post-feminist discourse? And he goes through a really interesting kind of history of the character and kind of using these different feminist discourses to explore it. And then Ayani Cooper in that chapter, she's doing a comparison with these two really exciting newer series, Monstrous and Pretty Deadly. So she's taking these female monsters in these two pieces and trying to understand them as female. Like these monsters are, most of them are not kind of traditionally embodied, right, as female, but trying to understand these monsters as female and those sort of border spaces around the feminine, around their hunger, around their sort of profane in the religious sense kind of understandings of their who they are, in order to, again, try to figure out kind of what the paradox is here of being female and monstrous at the same time. So just all of these together, right, trying to kick off the different kinds of big themes and kind of give people an idea of both the kind of more mainstream comics kinds of stuff that we think more of our readers might be familiar with, and then kind of get us into some of the other kinds of comics that we'll be exploring as well.
Yeah, I would just, I think I would add that one of the cool things about the way that first section operates is what, we've got a quote there early on by Jeffrey Jerome Cohen, mm-hmm. Where he talks about the sort of paradoxical nature of the monster, right? Like that you can't actually, you can't collapse it into an either or logic. And I think that that's really interesting with respect to origins. People mm-hmm. often go searching for origins because they are looking for some kind of fixity, right? They're mm-hmm. trying to dispel anxieties or fears. And so if you can trace and track and then fix the origin of something, it supposedly will give you this kind of explanatory framework that's going to get rid of any ambiguity. And the really fascinating thing about the progression of these chapters is that origins become less and less a source mm-hmm. of comfort and more a source of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, they are both, right? So I'm thinking about Ayani's chapter here in particular, when she's talking about the comic Monstrous. You know, there is this sort of searching for the truth of a particular character's origin, but the more they find about that, the worse everything gets. And so it is a kind of fascinating way for us to play as well with these larger concepts. I would also say that from a feminist perspective, trying to think about agency within patriarchal contexts is always going to be a paradoxical project. How does one act with intention when you are, when you find yourself in a social sort of setting that precludes your ability to do that? So again, you know, as Elizabeth said, what we're really hoping to do with this first section is set readers up for the kinds of things that they can expect to find throughout the book.
Yep. And then you move into, I think that's really interesting because a lot of this and a lot of women in comics, but sort of these ideas of women becoming villain or monstrous has to do with body, right? Mm-hmm. And constructions of the body, which is your sort of part two, but also with when part three, four, right? When we get into childbearing and childhood and those kinds of things. And so I found that really interesting as you talk to it and reading as you set that up. So can you talk about then what you see with this second part, the importance of the body and the body sort of as monstrous? And chapter four has one of my favorite newer comic book heroes, right? I love Faith and Zephyr. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what you saw going on with like body and how we sort of present the women and the body.
Yeah. So again, this is something that presented itself based on the chapters we had submitted, but that also really resonates with the larger framework of monster studies. It is primarily through embodiment that monstrosity is constructed. And so it made a lot of sense to us that this would be a main theme, although, as you've pointed out, it sort of oozes over every single section. I mean, I think that embodiment and bodies are our main part of everything that we've got in this book. So Stephanie Snyder's chapter, The Unremarkable Fatness of Valiant's Faith, is really fascinating because she does a lot with fat studies and disability studies to look at how it is that fat bodies have been made monstrous in certain societies. But then she pushes that even further and asks if, basically, if Faith's fatness is monstrous enough. So one of the things that we get from monster theory is that monstrosity is never just a marker of horror and abject. It's also a marker of desire. When a certain type of body is framed as monstrous, it's on the one hand because it evokes fears in a certain society, but also because it evokes a sort of seduction, a sort of forbidden desire, right? And so for Stephanie, she was really interested in whether this comic successfully presents fatness in a sort of liberatory or progressive way, or if it's sort of been sanitized. Has the monstrosity of this fat woman been defanged? Does the subversive quality of it get stripped away by virtue of being framed as a sort of somewhat mainstream superhero? And I think she does a great job with that, right? She's both welcoming of the sort of more diverse representation of embodiment in superhero comics in particular, but also still constructively critical and really forcing us to ask ourselves what it is that we want when we make claims for desiring things like greater representation. I think the following chapter by Charlotte Fabricius is, again, it's a really great chapter to have in conversation with Stephanie's chapter because she's really building on disability theory to look at Gail Simone's run on the DC comic Batgirl. And again, asking very similar questions, right? So for a character that Barbara Gordon as Batgirl, who spends a time in a comic series as a disabled person, as a wheelchair user, and becomes a kind of alias called Oracle. Charlotte is asking if, again, that's actually a kind of exciting and interesting inclusion into superhero comics, mm-hmm. or does it eventually get normalized and sanitized? Is the monstrosity of a disabled superhero sort of washed away by virtue of the retcon of the storyline? And spoiler, she sort of becomes able-bodied again at various points in this story. She leaves that alias of Oracle. She is no longer a wheelchair user and has full capacity of her body in ways that, you know, we are normatively told bodies should work. So again, there's a lot of push and pull here. And we think again about that Cohen quote. It's not an either or thing. I mean, it's very slippery to kind of be engaged in these types of analyses. And what I really like about both is that they are constructively critical, but they are not destroying what they love. I mean, these are still very tender chapters that treat their sources with a lot of love and respect. The final chapter in this section by Carrie Chris Wagner is really fascinating. And I think for both Elizabeth and I, this was the farthest outside of our own wheelhouses. So Carrie is a social scientist and was bringing quantitative methods that she, in fact, sort of pioneered into this analysis, and it really blew us both away. I don't know, Elizabeth, if you want to talk a little bit more about this chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that she was looking at both the queerness and violence in this, and then kind of looking at the way that these elements work in this book. So the book she's talking about here is Insects, which is hard to say on a podcast, but is spelled I-N and then S-E-X with a little T-S at the end. But the idea is that there are these Victorian characters who are, through various means that I won't get into, turning into giant bugs and eating each other. And part of what's going on in here, though, is this kind of queer relationship between some of the main characters, and then the kind of she's noticing the kind of elements of punishment and reward around queerness, right? So the idea that there's this kind of this understanding in a lot of fiction that queer characters are, you know, punished for their queerness, like by the narrative, that the plot and the author will often kind of violence will happen to characters the further they go outside of, you know, quote unquote norms, right? So part of what's going on here is she's tracking that. So she tried to find a kind of mathematical way to track this kind of work, and, you know, did an interesting job of showing us how it, you know, the relationship between queerness and violence in the comic. And honestly, the way that this kind of pushed at the boundaries of where Sam and I are in our own study, right, in our own work, in terms of like just the methodology involved, was really interesting. And one of the reasons that I really like this project, right, because we are, while we're both, you know, work a lot in comics, and we, you know, certainly have our own sort of grounding in philosophy and that kind of thing, these people were bringing their own methods, their mm-hmm. own kinds of methodological expertise. So, you know, having to, you know, work with them across this to both translate this into something that would make for a coherent book, right? A coherent overall piece, but also let them, you know, let them fly their flags and mm-hmm. do their stuff and, you know, and actually use their expertise to the fullest extent was one of the most rewarding parts of the project, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so it's interesting because then you move into this sort of discussion of, or the next three in the part three, right? The next three chapters move into this discussion of childbearing and motherhood and what that means and how that sort of represented, but how that sort of fits into these larger narratives. And so can you talk a little bit about those chapters as well and what you see going on there, and also how it sort of compares and relates to what you were just talking about with the that previous section on the body?
Yeah, absolutely. So here again, I mean, I think that without question, embodiment and bodies are a huge sort of locus for how monsters are made and the meaning that monsters make through bodies. And specifically, we're looking in this section at bodies that bear children, which in some instances means maternity and means women bearing children, but in some instances it doesn't. And so that again was really fascinating for us, this idea of really pushing back at our assumptions of the sort of foregone conclusions about reproduction and gender and embodiment. So here again, too, I think to echo Elizabeth's point, we have a really fascinating collection, not only of different methods of analysis, but also different types of comics. And that's another thing that I think we felt really strongly about from the beginning. Again, Elizabeth and I have done each of us work in superheroes, but that is not the whole of what's available in comics, right? Comics is just this profoundly fascinating medium that manifests in so many different ways. And so we wanted this book to be a sort of a hydra in both how scholars were able to approach their study, but then also the kinds of texts that were analyzed. And I think this is a good section for that. So Jeannie Ludlow starts by looking at several texts. She does take a brief look at a superhero comic, but the focus of this chapter is more on comics that are about pregnancy and abortion. And one of them is a sort of autobiography in a way. So you get a different kind of combination of genres within this one chapter. And she is really playing with sort of postmodern feminist ideas, like work from Donna Haraway and Trinity Minha about being othered, and specifically along the lines of being othered via having a pregnant body. This is a really good chapter too for that sort of decoupling of pregnancy with gender. So for instance, one of the comics she looks at is, like I mentioned, a sort of autographic or autobiography of a person who identifies as non-binary and their sort of experience of being pregnant and how they're made to feel monstrous by virtue of their pregnant body and their gender identity. So really, really fascinating stuff. We really got excited by Marcela Murillo's chapter because she's bringing in Bolivian comics, which are kind of equivalent of manga. They look and read similar to manga, but obviously they're sort of unique productions of Bolivia. And so here again, she surveys a series of comics to look at how Chola mothers are portrayed and how Chola women in particular, in a sort of post-colonial context of Bolivia, are made monstrous for a number of reasons, for ethnic and nationalist reasons, as well as gender and then presumptions about sexuality. She does a really great job of situating that analysis within a broader sort of cultural study of the shifts that have been taking place, specifically around ideas of indigenous populations in Bolivia. So there's no really denying that Chola mothers are sort of made monstrous, and specifically they're sort of derided in terms of their maternity. Are they good mothers? Then the answer generally is no in these various depictions. But she does a great job of contextualizing that for us. She's showing that this does not happen in a vacuum. And this was really important, again, for us to be able to show that monsters are social creations. They make meaning within particular cultural contexts. And I think Marcella's chapter is a really good example of that. The last one, too, really powerful, by Tamiko Kuribayashi. She's working with a manga text, and this one is a great example. The text is called Marginal, of that sort of oozing, that slipperiness, that inability to say either or when you're looking at reproductive bodies and their relationships to gender. So the main character in this comic, it's almost impossible to understand this character's whether you want to go with sex or gender identity. Through various points in the narrative, we're made to believe that the character is at least what we would say assigned male at birth, but they don't present in normative masculine ways, and the relationships that they have, both intimate and interpersonal, defy our sort of heteronormative expectations. And then again, how this particular character reproduces it totally sort of blasts apart anything that we understand about biological reproduction and childbirth. And so again, we're kind of thinking through the horror that evokes, but then also Tomoko has a lot of really interesting questions about how that has liberatory potential for women who have traditionally been assumed to be the source for childbirth within patriarchal cultures. What would it mean to start thinking about the possibility for other embodied types of people to reproduce? Would that actually provide women some kind of freedom from these sort of normative expectations that have been laid because, again, of their specific embodiment and relationship to reproduction? So yes, I mean, again, what we're seeing here, a survey of different types of comics, different methods of analysis. Tamiko is using a lot of postmodern theory, but a lot of work that's also borrowed from analyses of science fiction. Marcella really brought something powerful in terms of bringing, at least for me, a genre that I was unfamiliar with previously, and also bringing in really good, strong post-colonial analysis. And Jeannie, I think, really gave us something valuable by showing us a range of different types of comics, and also was writing from a very personal place. In addition to being an academic, she is an activist for women's choice and reproductive freedom. So all throughout that, you're getting a sort of compounding of the themes that we've seen already, agency and paradox, embodiment, and specifically then bringing all that within the frame of thinking about what reproduction and childbearing means in its relationship to certain types of bodies and gender identities.
And I have to just say, as a mother whose 10-year-old daughter has become very obsessed with manga, right? Uh-huh. And all the, I really appreciated that inclusion through, right? In these different parts, because often, yes, we are just like, we're gonna do the superhero thing, or we do the, we're going to call it a graphic novel. So it doesn't sound like a comic thing. Right. and so I really appreciated that. And I also do find that I have a number of students who are very interested in manga and interested in, I have one student in particular who I'm like, I need to send her this chapter because she's very interested in sexuality and sexual identity and how that sort of plays out throughout both Japanese work and Chinese work and thinking about those kinds of things. So I just have to say, I really appreciate those inclusions in your book. And speaking of motherhood, your next one is sort of this idea of the role of monsters of childhood is your part four, and thinking of what that means and this often a relationship between women and children. So can you talk a bit about like some of the different ways you're sort of challenging and looking at that in the writers are in these in these chapters?
Sure. I mean, part of what we were trying to do here is to talk about these as these are monsters that are sort of in one way or another kind of meant for children, although not maybe our manga example here in the middle. I'll give a little warning about that one, but that these are at least monsters that are part of childhood in some way. So Dan Yesbeck wrote this great chapter for us where he really takes you on a ride talking about Magica Dispel, who's a character from the world of Donald Duck and Scrooge McDuck, where she is the kind of witchy character from the Scrooge McDuck universe, right? So these Carl Barks sort of mid-century Disney comics. And just how sort of perverse in a certain way this character is, right? That as a duck, she's kind of defying the connection between women and children. She's a kind of, she's a vamp in all kinds of different ways, and a monstrous threat to Scrooge and his empire and, you know, just sort of the social order of their world. He does a great job of kind of, first of all, just his writing is a ride in a lot of ways. He loves the kind of pun and the rhythm of his words is really great, actually. Just kind of riding you through everything that's going on in Duckburg, and everything that happens in those, including these sort of hypocrisies around gender and class. I will never look at Donald Duck the same way again, for sure, after walking through that with him. But then the speaking about manga and the idea of Japanese comics, so the next chapter, Novi Shinchen and Shogawa introduced us to the work of this really classic Kyoko Okazaki work in sort of horrifying adolescence. So the historical context of all of this is 1990s Japan and the sort of economic struggles and the crisis going on in the 90s in Japan around, especially around female sexuality and the sort of low birth rate and the idea of those social struggles taking shape in this one career. So the author here, the artist, was critical of the ways that young women were being portrayed during this time and tries to, in this comic work that kind of edges on the border of the pornographic, is trying to, you know, think about the way women's bodies are commodified in a really nuanced and interesting way. I wanted to read the chapter, but, you know, just the way that they're kind of walking you through the sort of ways that these different pieces work in that historical and cultural context is really fascinating. And then speaking of a cultural context that I think really makes a huge difference, Xingjian Zhang did this chapter for us about the snake woman. So the snake woman is a figure, a sort of ancient classic figure in Chinese mythology, who kind of resurfaces in some modern storytelling in the 1980s in this animation series and comic called The Calabash Brothers. And basically, she walks us through the sort of cultural history of Snake Woman and how this woman who's a snake, right, could be considered in some ways a kind of healer figure, but then also a threat, and how the culture changing around Snake Woman is what turns her into a more existential threat. What's interesting about this is that she's using, again, her sort of art history language to walk us through all of this. Again, it's a woman who's embedded in a children's story, right? This is a monster of childhood. She's embedded in a children's story, but she's also trying to teach kind of the authors of her, how she works in there as villain and monster, are trying to teach them something about what it means to be the right kind of woman. And I just found it really fascinating, especially the kind of, because she's trying to walk us through this as a piece of art history, you know, and a piece of cultural history. She just walked us very carefully through everything that's going on in this piece and in this character.
So you end with this sort of examinate, right? This bringing everything together, I guess. Mm-hmm. These contested space, right? You talk about being a monster, being sort of in a contested space, in a sort of space that challenges traditional gender norms and identities and areas. And so you sort of end with three pieces that start to get at that. I mean, not that the whole book isn't pushing at that, mm-hmm. but the focus of these three is to sort of really push at that role of monster and what that means. And so can you talk about sort of how you closed out this collection?
Yeah. So I think that in a way, this section also highlights one of the main sort of points of focus that we have throughout the whole project. So when you're coming at sort of monster studies from a feminist perspective, there is the potential to come up with nothing but a litany of abuses. It could just wind up being a sort of survey of all the horrible ways that women are treated monstrously and the sort of, monstrous experiences they have in patriarchal or curiarchical cultures. And we really didn't want that. And I think that's also a really kind of one-dimensional reading of monster theory that we have to keep reminding ourselves, while it is about a certain type of subject who evokes fear, that that person is also in some ways an embodiment of power. They also evoke desire. And so we were trying to really sort of round out the book by thinking about how, on the one hand, various women get placed into the role of monster completely against their will, and maybe sometimes even without their knowledge. And they're sort of cast in this role. And so we wanted to look at what that might mean. What are the actual ramifications of being put in the role of monster? But then we were also interested in various types of women characters who you expect to be framed as monstrous according to their cultural context, but who absolutely defy that characterization by everything that they are and how they choose to be. So with the first chapter, we have Justin Weigard doing a really impressive sort of combination of traditional comparative literary analysis and visual rhetorical analysis. So he's looking specifically at the character in the epic Beowulf. He's looking at Grendel's mother. And so he begins by doing a sort of historical overview of the various renditions of the story, and again, a sort of comparative analysis of the language that's used and how it changes over time, such that this character becomes increasingly monstrous. And so he's asking a lot of questions about the translators and about the various renditions of the text to try to figure out why. Why is it that certain vocabulary goes from being a bit more generic to identifying her in very specifically monstrous ways? And we're talking about a character then who obviously doesn't really exhibit any kind of agency. We don't really get any character traits. She is a kind of classic monster. And so what does that mean? How does that particular type of character make meaning? So he looks to sort of visual rhetorics of a graphic novel interpretation of Beowulf to try to determine what it is that the creators are hoping to say by creating this role. And so he's got a lot of really good critical questions about who's actually being depicted here, whose anxieties, whose fears, what kinds of desires are being evoked through the visual rhetorics in the book. And again, does that actually have anything to do with women and with mothers? Or is this all kind of a boys' game? With Pauline Reynolds and Sarah Durazo Damas's chapter, here again, they're looking at a comic called The Jaguar that features a character who I guess in some ways we can kind of unproblematically say, yeah, she aligns with monstrosity because she can transform her superpowers, allow her to become the jaguar, so a sort of bigger, stronger, pseudo-bestial character who can fight bad guys. But that's not really what makes her monstrous. In the context of this comic, she is a foreign, basically, student. She's Latina. She winds up in a campus that's very waspy. And so she's put in the role of monster, not because of her claws and her strength and her increased size, but because she is a woman, she's a foreigner, and she's Latina. And so here again, we're sort of examining the role of monster. What kind of assumptions do we have about certain types of people, and how are they forced into that role versus how do they occupy it by will? Similarly, that last chapter by Christy Knopf is about a comic called Saucer Country, and then a version of it called Saucer State. And she's looking at the main character, Arcadia Alvarado. Now, this is somebody that, again, based on her identity within at least a fictional U.S. society, but it's recognizable to us as being resonant with what we would understand because she's a Mexican-American woman. She has a has been abused in her past. She's divorced, and she's in politics. This is exactly the type of person that we would expect to be framed as monstrous by a society which is white supremacist and patriarchal and so on. But then also her various encounters with politicians, most frighteningly, and then with aliens, sort of less worryingly, we start to have questions about whether she will start to exhibit monstrosity. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what Christy really shows us is that this person pushes back against all of that. She is being solidly sort of shoved into the role of monster, but in fact, the way that she performs her role as who she is, as the culmination of her experiences, actually is completely divorced of monstrosity, and the people that really become the villains, the bad monsters by the end, are nothing like her at all. Mm-hmm. So that push and pull was really important to us. Mm-hmm. And again, I think there's something really kind of invigorating about all of these chapters because we get to see in the latter two cases, how women have the capacity to push back even when they've been assigned a particular role. And then even with Justin's work, we can kind of confidently say that sometimes whether it looks like a woman, it may have absolutely nothing to do with women at all. And it's telling us something about different types of people altogether.
Mm-hmm. And it made a lot of sense that here at the end, especially our piece here is actually pushing back at the whole idea of monster. Like, that felt really appropriate to us, that the way the book kind of takes us in an arc from, well, is monster the idea to be interrogated here, and kind of takes us on a ride all through it until we're finally, you know, questioning it at the very end, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's any book that's simply monsters and doesn't question its own monstrosity, I think, is not the book for us. We wanted something that kind of had those porous edges. And I mean, that's one of the things that you might have seen in taking you through the kind of sections, is that, you know, every border bleeds. Every piece of this is a little bit porous. There's no part of it that stands completely by itself. Every part of it has kind of ideas that work in the other places as well, which mm-hmm. for a book about using monster theory and the monstrous, I think really works.
Yeah, I mean, I do. And I really appreciate that about this collection, that, and you've said it before, but that idea that it isn't just like, let's look at the superheroes and how, you know, monster is created in this more traditional way, but sort of pushing at some of these traditional sort of narratives that we often think about when we think about the monstrous in comics. We've been talking for a while, so my final question is this: what are you doing next? I mean, we're in this weird like space right now in the world, all waiting for 2020 to come to its end, hopefully soon. Are there things you are either working on with this collection? I know that conferences and that kind of thing are not really going on in the same way, but whether it's with this collection or anything new that either or both of you are working on that you sort of want to put out there or share?
Well, I will just say that even after the conference, we were still getting emails from people asking if there would be another one the following year. And mm-hmm. uh-huh. that wasn't in the works at the time. But I think that is something, again, that for us is very intentional with this book. This is not the only book that could be written about monstrous women in comics. And it certainly is not the only one that could be composed about monstrosity and comics. And so whether we're a part of future conferences or projects that continue this framework of monstrosity, I think that it's really fruitful and exciting. And I think there's a lot of people out there doing work that's sort of further exploring the intersections of all of these themes. And I think that's awesome. I'm really excited to see more, to read more. We may be a part of it somewhere along the lines, but this was the project we wanted to make, and it's discrete in a way. This particular collection, these particular themes mm-hmm. were what we could do, hoping that it would inspire others to do more. From a personal place, I will say I'm currently working, we've been excited about moving beyond superheroes, but I am actually working on a book project that's looking specifically at female-led superhero comics. And so that's sort of my focus. I've been developing the work over the last several years, but now it's time to actually pin it all down into a book. And so for the next 12 months or so, I'll be pulling that manuscript together and hopefully have it submitted to a press by about this time next year.
Well, for me, I can't, my work in the monstrous, like this kind of monster theory work, really got its hooks into my teaching. So I do, for my Morningside College, my employer, I do a yearly course, for freshmen. Ours is called Critical Inquiry and Communication, but it's the sort of pick a topic and try to help people understand the ins and outs of college. And so my theme for the last couple of years has been monsters and fears. And the process of taking students through these monster ideas, you know, taking someone who's, you know, 18 and walking into the college for the first time and talking to them about monsters has been really rewarding. Like, these ideas have legs. They work on a teaching level in a way that I really didn't, fully wasn't sold on, but knew I was working on the project. And so wanted to get it into my classroom. You know, and then on the other side of it too, thinking about just the comic side. So my current project is I'm working, to do a second edition of Understanding Religion and Popular Culture, which is a Routledge Press book. And I can't stop thinking about the sort of lessons that I learned from this collection, getting together those kinds of pieces from people. And again, letting people play to their strengths intellectually, trying to find people doing things from a wider diversity of fields and points of view to really give the work a richness. So yeah, that's it. I feel like this collection has taught me a lot just in the process of doing it with Sam. It has been such a joy.
Well, that is a wonderful note then to end on. Again, this was Sam Langsdale and Elizabeth Cody talking about Monstrous Women in Comics, their new edited collection. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much for the invitation. This was a really awesome conversation.
Yes, thank you.